So it was one of those emails that you just can't stop reading. It goes on, and your eyes just get wider, and your mouth drops, and it just completely warps the fabric of space and time. And here's what it was. I had just recently come out with the GitLamp documentary, a documentary about text adventures. And so I had a whole bunch of people who were sending me ideas and reactions related to text adventures. But one guy, he had an idea, and he kind of laid it all out there for me. It was the idea that we could bring back Infocom. Infocom being the number one dominant voice of text adventures in the 1980s. It had gone out of business effectively in 1987, although it hadn't closed doors until the early 1990s, and he wanted to bring it back. I told him the idea was utterly doomed. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, Brenda Romero, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are helping me get out of debt. The idea that this fellow was writing to me about was grandiose, to say the least. It centered around the idea of creating another Infocom product. Infocom products like Zork and Deadline and Trinity and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy were legendary. Everybody who lived during that time thought that it was one of the finer uses of a computer. At least they had a strong opinion one way or another. And he wanted to bring that glory back. He pitched it this way. There'd be crowdfunding, of course. People would pitch in and have different levels. And a super team would be put together of original Infocom implementers. People like Steve Moretzky, Stu Galley, Mark Blank, Mike Berlin, Dave Lebling, Brian Moriarty, Hollywood Dave Anderson, Amy Briggs. They'd all be brought together, and there'd be an event, kind of a dinner, where there'd be a large table with all of the imps at it, and there'd be other tables too. People would be talking and chatting, and the implementers, over dinner, would start to sketch out some idea for a game. You know, they'd pitch it, and if you were at a high enough tier, I mean paying lots of money, you could be sitting at that table listening to this magic happen. This is when I knew this pitch was kind of going to be different. And then all of these implementers would then work with a staff, and they would put together a true and honest Infocom game designed from the ground up to capture the previous glory. And a deluxe package with feelies and maps and all of the accoutrements of an original Infocom game would be made available in physical form. And then, depending on your tier, you would get copies of this or play it online. You know, it would be in every single way like you reached into a time machine and pulled out a brand new Infocom. You have to give him credit. That's out-of-the-box thinking. Now, the reason I think this idea is utterly doomed is because there's a very specific environment that programs like games are made in. They are highly creative endeavors, and the games that are made in one part of one's life are different than the games you'll get later. You know, not unlike writing or music or really any kind of creative act. And the games that were created at Infocom in the 1980s, these were based off of the work of living and breathing everything Infocom 24 hours a day by 20-somethings who in some cases had come from MIT and in other cases had assembled from around the country. And these folks, I can't stress it enough, made Infocom the center of their lives. In interviews I conducted with them, they all talked about the collegial atmosphere and the games and the parties and just a crackling energy from daily lunches and hanging out and bouncing ideas off of each other over the course of weeks or months. And to be able to think that you could have a dinner or even a couple dinners or even a week or two and start to aim towards that level of intensity, well, it's just not going to happen. There were attempts, by the way, to bring back some of the Infocom magic. Very specifically, there's one that's basically the dream version of what was being proposed here. It's called Zork, the Undiscovered Underground. It was created by Berlin and Blank, which was Mike Berlin, Mark Blank, and a staff who would work out their ideas. As I understand it, the way that the Undiscovered Underground was created was basically a series of phone calls. Two implementers would be made available over the phone, and they could be called for text and writing and whatever came off the top of their heads while staying at home, you know, seeing their families, living a different life. But somebody would call them up, ask them Zork questions, and then they would kind of give answers. And if you've played the game, it's less about handily crafted puzzles dragging you to the edge. It was meant to be a bonus, a kind of a extra bonus round. It's almost, basically, a cover, much like a compilation of previous works by a band might have an extra track that the band got together and recorded and which could be pointed to for sales. If you actually want to stretch this even further, you could look at something like Spellcasting 101, which was created by Steve Moretzky, working with Bob Bates at Legend Entertainment. Bob had done work with Infocom. He was basically an implementer, and when it shut down, he still had the technology to do a different kind, but similar kind of text adventure, and he hired one of the best writers, Steve Moretzky, to work on a game. And Spellcasting 101 was a decent enough game. It had its own peaks and valleys. It had its own outlook and had graphics to boot. But nobody would confuse it with an Infocom game, even though it had one of its best writers working for it. I think when you try to capture old magic, you find yourself with a kind of forced atmosphere. I think it's better to say, everybody who worked here, you had some really good ideas, and I bet you still have some. Why don't you tell us about them and go from there? So, for example, Steve told me that at one company, he was trying to propose, and he was constantly pitching, really, a game about the game industry. This would have been around 2000. And I still think of the lost opportunity of a Steve Moretzky-designed game industry commentary game. I just can't imagine the kind of observational humor he would have had in there about games at the time and how we would have internalized the different characters and would have applied the characters that he came up with to templates of game industry people in the modern era. Oh, here comes another whatever. Oh, they are a definite whatever. I don't know. I would have really liked to have seen that game, but nobody wanted to make it. I was listening to a podcast a little while ago where one of the people there who creates a bunch of stuff people know talked about how many different projects were proposed and went through the ringer and then just were dropped. And they had all the potential to be as good as anything you might see or experience, but the stars don't align, somebody isn't available, they're not able to get the funding they need at that exact moment, and it just falls and disappears, and maybe a few pieces from it are used later. This is something that happens all the time. And of the Infocom implementers, a notable amount kind of stopped making games. They kind of moved on to other worlds involving academia or writing or different kinds of educational systems or straight-up programming. They got a different life, and there were only a handful who stayed in the games industry. And some of those folks are ones that people just didn't know about as much. People like Mike Dornbrook, who had really been instrumental in the success of Infocom, but didn't write a single game. He was Steve Moretzky's roommate. He was the one who introduced Steve Moretzky to computers and text adventures being a thing. He was the one who came up with the InvisiClues. He had come up with a lot of the ideas that people think of as Infocom. And he went on to work on the Rock Band series of games. In fact, the success of that company's work probably really applied to the fact that he had seen some of the problems that had occurred with Infocom towards the end and the acquisition by Activision, and he didn't want to repeat those. But, you know, even with that amount of warning and experience, there was still a lawsuit. He was still involved in a whole bunch of mess and problems towards the end as just two companies dealt with each other after acquisition. Steve Moretzky stayed in games. He's continued to do lots of wonderful work. Much of it is aimed towards simpler games, puzzles, one-off creations. And of course, now he's more of a manager, but, you know, he kept in it. This was an industry that he loved working in, and he's continued to do it. Bob Bates just had a Kickstarter and created a game called Thaumastry. It's meant to be evocative of the original Infocom. It's out there. It exists. He got crowdfunded. He released it. He's continuing to update it, improve it, do all the great work. So if you want to see what the modern Infocom era would have been, I think we're there. It's just one of those tropes that I encounter a lot, where people look at the pieces of a game or computer experience and they want to bring it back. And bringing something back isn't just a matter of cloning some of the pieces and providing them as they were and then saying, ta-da! I mean, we are a different species than when we started out. We experience machines differently. Our world is wired differently. It's a really fascinating time to be alive, and it's kind of been that way all my life. It's just not the same kind of world, and just wholesale bringing together what used to be and thinking that that's the end of it. You know, it's so much more than that. In just a short time, I'll be going out to Kansas Fest, which is the Apple II conference I attend every year. I love that place. And the reason I do is because there's such a beautiful mix of this 40-year-old machine combined with people bringing new sensibilities and new ideas into it. It doesn't feel stale or nostalgic or putting a rose-colored filter on the way things used to be. It's actually a kind of combination sandwich of new, classic, and old. It's all in every single way a living, thriving community. I really enjoy spending time with them, and every year it re-energizes me. After the Infocom wave, there was an entire other world of interactive fiction creators and writers, and they survive to this day creating new works, and they've been adapting to different technology. You know, there's programs like Twine that make creating text adventures, or at least interactive pages, into something pretty easy where you focus on what your idea is more than getting the coding just right. It's thriving, it's engaging, it's winning interactive fiction awards. There's been a lot of studies about what made Infocom great and what worked, but that stuff won't work now. I really don't think it will. I mean, if you play in it, the tropes have been explored. People have found what they like and they don't like. That said, there is one aspect of the modern world that really excites me. And that's the proliferation of beautiful, complicated game engines. These game engines are coming out from all sorts of vendors, and they get a lot of the work done. They figure out the networking, the graphics, the interaction with mobile, with consoles. They aren't perfect. You always have amounts of programming to do and edges to sand off, but a creator, somebody who has an idea, a thought, they can start working in this environment knowing that a lot of the really painful, low-level work that was the hallmark of early 1980s and 1990s programming, it's gone. You don't have to wonder about sound card settings or whether the graphics are going to fit or whether things are running right. There's an entire engine there to support you and to be able to port it to different hardware and different consoles. You can focus entirely on your game idea. There's families of games out there that never would have existed in a million years, or at least wouldn't have the quality and the polish that they do now, were it not for these game engines, new and old, commercial and free, available right now to tinker with. My favorite moment with computers, and I mean I have so many moments that matter to me, my favorite moments are downloading a tool and messing with it, finding out that something can add textures or create physics or interact with two different things and let me experiment with what that linkage is and then going through it and then putting it out again. Even if I never create something finalized and polished and go through those levels of iteration, that joy of putting my hands into an environment and a tool and playing with that wonderful, wonderful place for a little bit and forgetting the world around me. I felt it when I played with BASIC in the 1980s. I felt it when I worked with Werkzeug, a demo creation tool by Faubrausch. I felt it when I've worked with Blender 3D or messed with a little tiny physics engine that I've now completely forgotten the name of, or another that I've forgotten the name of, which allowed you to interact with pixel art and do physics in a pixel level. These little toys that become tools, that become vehicles for imagination. This is the most exciting and amazing thing to me. And the idea that some kid who has the same drive that I did when I was 13 and wanted to express things, and all I had was graph paper and dreams, to know that they could get a mid-sized computer, download one of these engines for free, and start making their ideas glow in the night. Who wouldn't want to stick around for that? What a joy to think that maybe 20 years after something they make, people will wish they could crowdfund a dinner to listen to this person talk about how they made the game, what it meant to them, and why they'd love to do it again one more time. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bighoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters who have helped make this podcast possible. I was out in California, and I started to feel a little funny. And it could probably be described as a little bit of a numbness on the left side, which unfortunately does set off a bunch of triggers as to things I should do. And I walked into an emergency room, got myself checked out, and nothing was obvious. Nothing's a big problem. And I've gone to see my primary care physician since, and we'll keep working on it. But there was a time when, even if I felt supremely weird, I would have been terrified of setting foot in an emergency room. The thought of the costs, the thought of having to pay those back, the thoughts of all the ways that could have ruined me a different way, and the risks that I would have put myself in, those have been gone. I take my health seriously, and thanks to this podcast, I don't mind throwing another few $100 down just to ensure I'll be around a little while longer. So thank you so much for that ease of mind.